Out chapter 13, you may remember that we were talking about the mark of the beast. There were those who had that designation. And in this chapter, we're going to see that there are others who have the mark of God in their foreheads, the 144,000. These clipboards are being passed around as we prepare the plan of work. So if you will, if there's something to be included in that, we'd like for everyone to have an opportunity to remind us of anything that occurred this year. All right, let's pick up in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 1. Observe that, and I wanted to, before we got into that, before we read the first verse, though, to remind you, as we were reading in chapter 11 in the last section, there was the seventh woe, and then we came to a section where there was a review, a rejoicing in heaven because the third woe is past, and now there is a victory of God's people and judgment over his enemies. That was just mentioned in a few verses in chapter 11, but now as we get into chapter 14, that's going to be expanded. The same idea that earlier had been requested by those who were under the altar in chapter 6, who said, "How long, O Lord, before our blood is avenged on the earth?" And God had said, not yet, be patient. There are others who have to suffer as you have suffered, but eventually that time will come. And that's what you have in chapter 14. That time has come. God's judgment is going to be poured out upon those who have rejected his gospel and persecuted his children. Now, that's just a little preview of chapter 14. Now let's read the text. I won't read all of it, but I'll highlight some ideas in the first section, beginning verse 1. "And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they were virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits of God unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they were without fault before the throne of God." That's the first section of this chapter. There are three sections, and they all begin with this phrase, "And I looked," or "I beheld." I've underlined that in my Bible. You might want to do that. The first three verses of verse 1, "And I looked," that introduces the first section that we read together. Then you notice verse 6 begins with, "And I saw." So there's the second section. The third section will be in verse 14, "And I looked." So you have those clues as to the changing of topic or consideration in this chapter. You could call this chapter, if you wanted to give it a title, "Righteous Judgment," because this is what's going to be poured out. God has been patient. God has been very fair in not using his power against his enemy, giving time for the people on the earth to repent. But now there is going to be a consequence to rejecting the gospel. I observed as I was reading this, and you probably have, that we have in this chapter one lamb and six angels. Still just summarizing the chapter, sort of getting the lay of the land. I put a box around the word angel the six times. You might want to do that. I'll just give you the verses. I notice in verse 6, "I saw another angel." So like we had these previous angels that had announcements to make, now again, angels are being used, employed in the same way. Verse 8 is the second time there followed another angel. And then verse 9, a third angel. So verse 6, verse 8, verse 9. And then you get down to verse 17, "And another angel came out of the temple." That's verse 17. Then verse 18, "Another angel." And number 6, the last one, verse 19, "And the angel thrust in his sickle." So, just looking at it from the bird's eye view, as a body of material, these are some of the keys that will stand out as we go through it, just getting the outline of the chapter. Now, I'd like to go back into this section, the first section with you, and spend some time. I hope to get down through at least verse 8 with us tonight, talk about the gospel that the angel preached in verse 8, if we get that far. And so let's see how it goes. We'll begin in verse 1 with a verse-by-verse study. So here you have John, as we have become accustomed to in the book, seeing a vision. This is a picture book, more than any other book in the New Testament. What you have is John seeing this great vision. We might picture a screen with a movie playing on it. And then John is describing what he saw. And sometimes he gets to participate in take up the book and eat it, or write this and so forth. Sometimes he just watches and tells us what he saw. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood. Now, this is going to be a sight for sore eyes, because the last two chapters have been scary chapters. If you wanted to look at it from the movie standpoint, as we just mentioned, those were PG-13 chapters, because you were introduced to the great red dragon in chapter 12, a very scary figure and a very frightful enemy of the Christians, representing the devil. And then in chapter 13, we saw the devil. Chapter 13, we saw the devil's two allies. Again, PG-13, scary chapter, the sea beast and the land beast. And when you read that, we interpreted it, you had the sea beast, the Roman government, the power of authority over the Christians, and could really make their lives hard, could arrest them, confiscate their belongings, even cause them to be martyred. And then you had the sea beast, false religion, that had teamed up with government, worship the emperor. If you don't have the mark of the beast, then you cannot buy and sell and so forth. And so those chapters are scary to Christians. If you had been living back there and you had received this message and understood what it was saying, then you would think, oh, this is going to be a very difficult time for the church. And you would be right. It was a very difficult two centuries, a little over 200 years, when the Roman persecution was intense against the Christians. But now in chapter 14, there is a contrast. We've gone back to G-rated, especially in the first part of the chapter, where we no longer have a scary dragon and scary beast. We have a lamb. A lamb is a beautiful creature, not threatening. And of course, a lamb in the book of Revelation, referring to Jesus, who died as a lamb for the sins of the world, John 1:29. That's what it represents here. And notice his father's name. So Jesus' father's name is written in the foreheads of the 144,000. Let's talk about Zion just for a minute. The lamb stood on Mount Zion. If you wanted to look at an overview of what Zion has been used to represent in Scripture, I'll give you several verses. We won't take time to read these tonight, but if you're jotting down notes, you may want to do that on your own time. Zion was the stronghold of David, 2 Samuel 5, verse 7. Zion is another name for Jerusalem. Zion is the mountain. Jerusalem is built on top of the mountain. And so David chose that city to be his capital during the time he was king. And he conquered it. He challenged his men, whoever can go up and find a way in, then I will make him the chief. And so up they went. They conquered the city that the people that lived there didn't think could be conquered. So it was a stronghold of David, 2 Samuel 5, verse 7. That stronghold idea then became a metaphor in the Old Testament. For instance, in Psalm 9:11, Zion is called Jehovah's dwelling place. The temple was built on top of Mount Zion. God, of course, moved into the temple, 1 Kings 8, the Spirit of God. So it was God's dwelling place on earth, where he communed with his people. It was called the city of the great king, Psalm 48, verse 2. Great king being God. And then the refuge for God's people, Psalm 48, verse 3. So those are the chief ideas from the Old Testament regarding Zion, a stronghold, God's dwelling place, city of the great king, and a refuge for God's people. And it was literally a refuge, of course, down through the ages. It's whenever God's people got the enemies of God would invade the land. But God's people would naturally flee to Zion and get in the stronghold with the big wall around the city. Very difficult for an enemy to get in there. And so they felt safe. They felt secure. Plus God protected them. So that's the idea that comes to us from the Old Testament to the New Testament. If you wanted to look at the New Testament, the chief verse would be a prophecy in the Old Testament about the New Testament. And that prophecy is found in Isaiah 2, 2 through 4, where God said He was going to establish His kingdom on the top of Zion, referring to the church being built. Of course, the church started in what city? The first day of the church was on the day of Pentecost. Where were the apostles and early Christians gathered on the day of Pentecost? Jerusalem, which was on top of Mount Zion. So God was establishing His kingdom in the earth, and all men would be able to flow into it. So here we are, thousands of miles away, and thousands of years later, and we have flowed into the kingdom. We have become a part of that same eternal kingdom prophesied in Isaiah 2 and fulfilled in Acts chapter 2, which was figuratively spoken of as Mount Zion. Now, there are several verses in the New Testament that refer to Zion. I'll just give you a synopsis again. If you want to jot down the references, then you may want to take time. It would be profitable to take time and read these later. Mount Zion is referred to six times in the New Testament. Whenever it's referred to in the present tense, it's talking about the church, as we just noted from Isaiah 2. Whenever it's in future tense, it's talking about heaven. So Zechariah 9, verse 9 is quoted twice in the New Testament, which refers to Mount Zion. Matthew 21, 5 and John 12, 15. And that was in relation to Zion rejoicing when her king came unto her. When Jesus came in the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, then Zechariah 9:9 was quoted twice relating to that, which refers to Mount Zion. Of course, He was coming into Jerusalem. Romans 9:33 and 1 Peter 2:6 quote Isaiah 28:16 about the cornerstone laid in Zion. Again, the idea of a stronghold. Romans 11:26 quotes Isaiah 59:20, out of Zion shall come a deliverer. And then Hebrews 12:22-24 quotes Isaiah 2:2-4, which we just referenced, and Micah 4:1-8, the parallel prophecy. So summarizing those, you have the rejoicing at the king coming into Zion. You have the cornerstone being laid in Zion. The cornerstone was Christ, the cornerstone of His church. The church is built on Him as the foundation. Out of Zion came a deliverer, and so the Savior was born, and His message was trumpeted throughout the earth, and then the kingdom of heaven was established in Mount Zion. All those ideas, you won't need to remember all the details of that, but I did want to each of us to be impressed with the fact that there's a lot of symbolism from the Old Testament that was attached to that single word, Zion. And it was an idea that would have resonated with God's people who were in a dangerous and difficult time. Remember, Christians, God has Mount Zion. He prophesied that it would be an eternal kingdom He would establish in the earth, and it would continue to last until the end of time. So if you're a part of that kingdom and you're taking refuge in Zion, then you would be protected. You would not be physically protected from persecution, but they could not touch the soul. They could only touch the body. They could arrest you, put you in prison, and kill you, but they could not take your salvation from you. You would still be, as he says here in Revelation 14:13, blessed are the dead that die in the Lord. All they could do was accelerate your opportunity to go to be with God, because they could not take from you what is truly valuable. And Mount Zion conveyed that idea. All right, now let's talk about the 144,000. We'll spend a little bit more time in this first verse than some of the others, because it sort of lays the foundation for the whole vision. And I looked, and a lamb stood on Mount Zion. So Jesus standing in His church, or the picture is of the church triumphant after the period of persecution. There are two ideas about what Mount Zion is. I need to say that before I go further. There are some commentators who say this is a picture of the church in heaven after everything here is done and we get to go home to be with God. And certainly the imagery fits that. It would not be any violation to the idea here or to the scriptures as a whole to say that, you know, we will be with the Lamb on Mount Zion as the ages roll on. We sing songs to that effect. But it seems to me it is more in the context of this book of Revelation to take the second view, which is this is the end of the 1260 days or the 42 months or the times and half time that we've studied up to this point. He's writing to these Christians about to go into this intense period of persecution. It's already started. It's going to get worse. And he's saying to them, let me take you to the end of it, to the Edict of Milan and to Constantine, and he didn't use the names, but that's what it's referring to, this period of time when finally the church has come out of this very difficult time of persecution and martyrdom, and now you're safe again. Well, the picture is that the church won and the emperor did not. They had all the upper hand during those times. They had power, they had false religion, they had the numbers, but when you fast forward down to the end of the persecution, who's left standing at the end? The Christians are, who were unlikely victors. So that, to me, is what this is talking about. The symbol of the Christians are the last ones standing when the persecution ends. Also would be true, of course, that we'll be standing as the world ends. But in context, that makes the most sense. Now, the 144,000. This is a book with a lot of symbols. You didn't need me to tell you that tonight. We've noticed that ever since the first verse of the book. So there are a lot of number symbols in the book. 144,000 is thought by commentators to represent this combination of numbers. 12 times 12. 12, the Old Testament, we saw earlier in chapter 4, Old Testament tribes, 12, a chief number representing that Old Testament period. 12 apostles representing the New Testament period. So God's redeemed from both Old Testament and New Testament. So 12 times 12 times 10 times 10 times 10. The number 10 representing completeness. So you triple it and this is complete, ultimate completeness. So you have a number that represents the redeemed of all the ages completed. Not just a specific 144,000 people, a subset of Christians, but the whole group of the Christians, the number being symbolic of all of the faithful, those who are willing to be martyred. It included those who were martyred, but also it included those who were willing to be martyred, that had the martyr spirit. This would be the same number that we saw earlier in chapter 7, 1 through 8, that were sealed in their foreheads before God unleashed his measured judgments, so that they would not be collateral damage, as we notice in that chapter. The same number, the same group of people that were sealed earlier now are the 144,000. But they're pictured as having come through this unscathed, or they've come through this victorious, and that would be a comfort to those who were about to face it. If you knew you were ultimately going to be successful, it'd make it a lot easier to bear up under this persecution. If you had doubts about whether it's really worth it to be a Christian, that would really make it difficult not to capitulate, worship the emperor, or give up on your faith. But having this reassurance that, wait, it's going to be all right, you're going to win, you can hold out, and it's worth it, that would be a very important message for these early Christians to have. All right, now let's move into verse number 2. And I heard a voice from heaven. Notice the word voice is used 3 times here. There is beauty for the eye, as we've seen these beautiful visions. In this case, the Lamb on Mount Zion, 144,000. That's a pleasant vision for the eye, but there's also beauty for the ear in the victory song. I heard the voice from heaven and the voice of many waters, and as the voice of great thunder, and I heard the voice of harpers harping with their hearts. Sometimes someone will go to this passage and say, see, they're going to have instruments in heaven so we can have instruments of music on earth and worship. But notice carefully what this is saying. This is an aside. I'm not going to spend much time here, but since this will come up sometimes, I'll just show it to you as you read it. It says, I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And what kind of book is this? Is it prose? Is it history? Or is it, what kind of literature are we reading? Poetry. We're reading the first verse of the book, which we have emphasized several times, but I think it's important because sometimes someone will try to pull out of the verse something literal that God never intended to be taken out literally. The revelation of Jesus Christ, the first verse says, which God gave unto him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass, and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. So just as in chapter 5, verse 8, it talks about the golden bowls of the prayers of the saints. Well, he's not saying we should bring in golden bowls into our services and use golden bowls as incense with our prayers. That would not be, even those who would bring the instrument in wouldn't say, no, we don't need to go the route of the Catholics and then burn incense in our worship. But the same idea would be to take this passage in Revelation 14 and say, well, that authorizes us to bring an instrument. It's not talking about a literal instrument, and it's not even talking about music. It's talking about voices that sound melodious. Voices as a harper harping, or as harpers harping on their harps. All right, now let's go into what it actually is saying. There are three ideas being communicated here. The sound of the voice of many waters would be the idea of majesty. Have you ever stood, for instance, at a waterfall or a great, like, I've never been to Niagara Falls, but some of you I'm sure have. I've been to a Little River Canyon, that great, when it's been raining a lot and that water is pouring over the falls, and just stand there and be impressed with the majesty of the sound of many waters splashing. It's a majestic sound. Well, that's the idea here. Here is John trying to describe to us what he's seeing in heaven, or what he's seeing in this vision of the victorious Lamb. It's majestic. It's the closest thing he could come to is like a many waters, the sound of the crashing waters of the waterfall. And then the second idea that's being communicated here, I heard the voice of great thunder. Thunder relates to volume. It's not just a little whisper. It's thunder. It's loud. It's impressive. And then the third idea is melody, and that's the harpers harping with their harps. So John was impressed visually with what he saw, but also impressed audibly with the voice that he's, the sounds that he's hearing, majestic, loud, melodious. All right, that moves us into verse 3. What is he actually hearing? I heard a new song, and they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. Now, we saw those same imagery in chapter 4, with the throne and the one who sits on the throne with the 24 elders and the beast around him, a picture of God the Father. So, and in the presence of God, they're singing a new song, no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. Now, why could only 144,000 know this song? It's not very complicated. It's because, well, let me read a verse with you. Turn with me to 2 Corinthians 2:14. And I think this is the perfect verse to explain why only some people could sing the song of redemption. We sing songs based on that verse. We're singing redemption, sweet song. And a lot of different songs tie into that passage that we're seeing in Revelation. But in 2 Corinthians 2, verse 14, I should say 1 Corinthians. I wrote down the wrong book. Flip back one more book. 1 Corinthians 2. All right, verse 14. Let's read 13 and 14 to see the contrast. Which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teacheth, but which the Holy Ghost teacheth, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. So he's talking about a spiritually minded person appreciating spiritual things, the things of God. In contrast with that spiritually minded person, he says, but the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him. Neither can he know them because they are spiritually discerned. See what that's saying? It's not saying he lacks the intellect to understand the facts of the gospel. It's saying he has no appreciation for it. It may be that someone in here tonight invited someone to come with you to the Bible class tonight. I said, why don't you go with me? We're going to be studying the book of Revelation tonight. And that old book. I'm not interested in studying the Bible. There's nothing good in there. A bunch of myths. Is that person going to learn the Bible? No. Why? Same reason a criminal doesn't find the policeman. He is not looking for him. He's trying to stay away from him. He's not interested in spiritual things. That's what it's talking about here in Revelation chapter 14. The reason that those with the mark of the beast, those who are unspiritual and worshiping pagans and serving the emperor and so forth, don't know redemption song is because they've never been redeemed. Because they have no interest in learning the gospel. It's not a lack of intellect or opportunity, but it is a lack of interest. So the 144,000, though, are like the man who was walking through the field in Matthew 13, and he stumbled upon the treasure that was hid in the field, and he went and sold all that he had, and he purchased the field that he might have it. Well, that represents, there are two parables in Matthew 13. That one, I mean, put the other one beside it, then I'll make the point together. The other one was of the man seeking goodly pearls, and he found the pearl of great price, and he liquidated his assets and bought that pearl. Remember, those are what are called twin parables because they're different stories that teach the same message. And the message is that if we have an appreciation for spiritual things, we can obtain them. Your presence here tonight indicates, I mean, you could be at home in bed or watching television or doing your homework or any number of things, but you've gotten ready and you've come to this place and you've made the sacrifice of time and energy to come. Why? Because you have an interest in spiritual things. You're seeking goodly pearls, as it were. Now, in those two parables, the real contrast there is that one man was seeking out. He was going from place to place looking for goodly pearls. He was on a mission. The other man's just wandering through a field, and he happens upon, oh, look, the rain last night washed the dirt off, and there's some treasure hidden. But both of them shared an appreciation for value, true value. One stumbled on it. One was looking for it. So there are people that will come through our front doors that have been going from church to church, just trying to find one that's teaching what the Bible says. That's the one seeking goodly pearls. There'll be others somebody will just invite them to, why don't you come with me Sunday? We'll go out and get lunch after. And, well, I don't have anything going on Sunday. I'll go with you. But then they're so intrigued with the message and they begin to study it. There's both kinds of people out there. Well, what you have here in Revelation chapter 14 is those people, regardless of which group they came out of, actively seeking or passively rewarded for recognizing value, those 144,000 can sing redemption's sweet song because they appreciated spiritual things and they were saved. Those who were not, and could not. So that brings us then to verse number 4. Let's talk about three characteristics of the 144,000 that were redeemed from the earth. These three characteristics, I'll give them to you before we read it, see if you see them. They're purchased, they're pure, and they are persistent. Those are supposed to be characteristics of us. So let's see those characteristics of these Christians and then think about how our lives should reflect the same truths. Purchased, pure, and persistent. Verse 4, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and the Lamb. So let's talk about redeemed first. It's in the last part of verse 3. It's in the last part of verse 4. Redeemed, the word redeemed means to buy back. Here I am, sold into sin. I've committed sin. Therefore, I'm in debt to the devil, in debt to God. So God says, well, I'll buy him back. Well, what's it going to cost God to buy me back from the devil? the blood of his son. So that's redemption's price. He bought me back. I've been redeemed. So there's purchase. They are purchased people. The price has been paid. But they are also pure people. Notice in the first part of verse, for these are they which were not defiled with women. Sometimes people will take this passage literally. Instead of, we said 144,000 is a figurative number representing all the saved of Old Testament, New Testament. But sometimes people will talk about there are only 144,000 people going to get to go to heaven and everybody else has to be on earth in some kind of renovated rapture. You know, the rapture at 144,000, everybody else is on the earth, period of tribulation. Well, to say that, we've already seen the violation of the context, of the figurative context, but also, if you're going to take that literally, that number literally, you also have to take this description literally. So the only ones that could go to heaven would be unmarried virgins who are males. No women, no married people, and no immoral people. Okay, so the 144,000 then becomes a very different group than most people imagine. It's not to be taken literally, it's to be taken figuratively. All right, so let's talk about what it means. Homer Haley says in his commentary that probably the first verse, the first part of the verse, they which are not defiled with women, is talking about their moral ethics. They're taken to mean what it says. They are not defiled with women in the sense that they, one of the, we studied in chapter 2 when these, in that culture, when you went to work for a certain masons or the carpenters or whatever, you joined the cult or joined the we would call them a trade union. And a part of that trade union had to do with attending these licentious parties where there were prostitutes. And so immorality was a part of culture. It also was a part of religion. Many of the pagan religions literally had fornication as a part of the services or at the place of worship. Now, in contrast with that kind of licentious behavior that was around Christians all the time, they did not participate in that. They kept themselves pure. They didn't act like everybody in the world. I don't guess it takes much imagination for Christians in our generation to appreciate that same truth, because even though it's not given a religious context, that's our world we live in. It's an immoral world that where immorality is expected of single people, be they teens or young adults or single again. But God is here rewarding those, praising those who keep themselves pure. Now the second reference, for they are virgins, probably, at least Haley says, would refer to their spiritual purity in the sense of 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2. In other words, why does he say it twice? They're not defiled with women and they're virgins. Well, maybe he has two meanings. They're morally pure, but they're also spiritually pure. 2 Corinthians 11, 2 talks about those who have not been corrupted from the simplicity of the gospel. If you go back to the Old Testament, there were one of the key figures or ideas of the prophets was whenever God's people would turn to these pagan or idols like Baal or Molech, they were committing adultery against God. So that was a figure that all religious people who knew the Bible were familiar with, because if they didn't keep themselves married to God and stay pure to His religion, but they turned to these other gods, and He said, that's like you're committing adultery against me. So that was the idea that is probably being brought over here. The spiritual purity, they did not compromise their faith. They stayed only true to the principles of Christianity, because it was very tempting to stay as a Christian, quote, but then also, you know, to burn the incense to the emperor just to get the libella so you could buy and sell, you know, compromise, but then, you know, give the form. And this is saying, no, you're spiritually pure. You're physically pure. You've maintained your religious principles. All right, this next part, the part that we haven't talked about, is the middle part where they are persistent. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever He goeth. Not just when it's easy, but also when it's hard. Not just when it's popular, but also when it's not. Not just when it's something that fits my personality or my interest, but when it doesn't. They follow Him whithersoever He goeth. They continue to be faithful under all circumstances, when they're blessed and things are going well in the culture, or when they have to go through a period of persecution, they follow the Lamb. The Lamb leads, they follow regardless of external circumstances. So those are the characteristics of the 144,000, those that get that have the victory in the end purchased, pure, and persistent. Now, let me touch on the first fruits, which I may have skipped that in the previous verse, but wherever that, no, it's in that last part of verse 4. I just mentioned for your notes that that's a reference back, of course, to Exodus 34, verse 5, where God always demanded the first fruits of the crop every year. You know, whenever those in Israel had a crop, they dedicated the first part of the sacrifice to God. Same thing with an animal. The first animal that a mother cow or any sheep or whatever, the first one belonged to God. And then any others that she had later, they could use. All right, verse 5. And in their mouth was found no guile. Guile means deception. So they didn't lie and say, Caesar is Lord. No, they wouldn't make that lie because he's not Lord, not in a spiritual sense. And they would not lie about their faith. So their mouths will found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Without, not sinless, because no man is sinless, but without fault, they've been forgiven of their sins and they have not deliberately violated their commitment to the Lord. So that gets us down through the first section. I thought we might get down a couple more verses, but that's fine. We'll pick up there next week. You may have a comment, though. Next week we'll talk about the angel who preached the everlasting gospel. That's a nice section of Revelation. Yes. I would like to make a comment.